The peace talks with Iran failed, and now President Trump has ordered the U.S. military to blockade the Strait of Hormuz. Oil prices have shot up. America's allies don't seem like they're on board with this. Yet Trump says we're winning. So what in the world did we win? Was this whole thing pointless? Welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is your weekly libertarian review of news and culture from the editors of Reason Magazine. And sometimes friends. I'm your host, Peter Suderman, and today I am joined by my colleagues, Catherine Mengu Ward, Matt Welch, and Nick Gillespie. Matt, I want to start with you. Trump says that no matter what happens, America won, right? Whether there's a deal, whether there's not, this is a big victory for America. So if so, like, do you agree with that? And if so, what did we win?
I don't think that it's a big victory for America. There are things that you can say that America has won or improved upon when looked at in a certain lens. You can say that we degraded Iran's navy by 90% or so. We severely degraded their ability to make and shoot missiles, although we didn't eliminate that. Set back their nuclear program, presumably. I don't know exactly how much. I don't think anyone else really does either. And made it more difficult for them to do mischief outside of their borders in the region. And so those things are strategic improvements. The question is, at what costs? And then also, what comes next? And are there bad knock-on effects that might undermine those gains? I think that there are, not least of which is that we seem to be shredding NATO in real time without having a plan of what replaces it, which is kind of an issue. We're fighting a war, a rhetorical war against the Pope for reasons that are a little bit obscure, but it doesn't seem awesome. And we have not incidentally, you know, blown up a girls' school, which is a horrible thing to have done. Yes,
do you think it's a Title IX violation, Matt?
At the very least, maybe even Title VIII. Small gains, yes, that are observable, but is that justification for a war, and particularly of the way it's going to be settled now that it's in the negotiations era? I don't think so.
I mean, Catherine, are those really gains? I'm not sure I totally agree with Matt on all of this. Yes, we destroyed a bunch of the Navy, but they still have a bunch of small boats that they can use to police or sort of block the Strait of Hormuz if ships are going through there, right? They've still got mines out in the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. military's position is they don't even know where their mines are, right? They've still got nuclear material, and it looks like, I mean, at least it's plausible that they're going to restart their nuclear program. And if they end up being able to control the Strait of Hormuz and charge tolls in Bitcoin, kind of funny, that's going to add billions to their bottom line. Iran's going to come out of this richer and having stood up to the world's great military power.
Yeah, the Free Press asked John Bolton if we're better off now than we were if we hadn't gone to war in the first place. And he basically just gave the first part of Matt's answer. He said, sure, because we've mowed the lawn. And that was his kind of whole, you know, start and stop. And that shows, I think, the mindset of people like that, people who are just looking at, well, what kind of incremental strategic gains do we make vis-a-vis Iran in this specific conflict right now? The second part of Matt's answer is also really important. And we have a forthcoming issue of the magazine with a cover story, which is titled A Pointless War.
Yeah.
Is it about this one or all wars?
The next one.
So I'm thinking we're going to be talking about Bruce Springsteen later, but he launched his U.S. tour with a rendition of Edwin Starr's War. What is it good for?
Spoilers.
Yeah.
We are going to be talking about Bruce Springsteen later. Nick, what about the international legitimacy argument here? I mean, you know, Matt mentioned we've got Trump saying, oh, we're going to barricade, blockade the Strait of Hormuz. And there's going to be all of these other folks involved.
He was seeking to open.
Yeah,
I mean, now it's like this shreds Trump. I mean, I think more than anything, the Iran war really highlights whether or not Trump is mentally defective at this point. When you see his, you know, he attacked the Pope in a long thing. I mean, this is what ChatGPT was made for, to scan and summarize Trump's Truth Social posts at this point. But he attacked the Pope for being soft on crime. Can you imagine that? The Vicar of Christ on Earth, like, wanting to give people a break. Nailed it to the cross, right?
He said he likes crime, I guess. I guess.
But, you know, on a serious level, this, you know, Trump has, you know, there's no question that we've further degraded Iran's ability to attack America, which it did not have, you know. And if you believe Trump a year ago, well, you know, the nuclear program was destroyed and we had set back their ballistic missiles. Our own intelligence a year ago said that there was no imminent threat. From Iran. Stuff later this year, just before we went in there, our intelligence said there were no imminent threats. So it's not clear what we're getting out of this other than a further destruction of any possibility of allying with anybody in Europe, a bunch of the countries in the Middle East. And then you get to this question of, like, what can you believe about Trump? You know, because Trump, before when the Pakistan peace talks started, he was like, no, we have an agreement with the ceasefire, the Strait of Hormuz will be open. And then Iran is saying, no, we never agreed to that. And it's like, when you really can't honestly say, you know, I think the president of the United States is probably telling the truth more than the Islamic regime in Iran, we've really lost the plot. And that's what we get out of all of this, plus higher gas and energy prices.
Yeah. What about this, you know, the blockade here, Matt? The Trump administration says that the goal is to force the Iranian government to, you know, give in to these terms that J.D. Vance flew to Pakistan to deliver, right? And that, like, by making them suffer economic pain, by cutting off their oil revenues, that's what's going to force them to give up their nuclear program, open the Strait and stop charging, you know, people Bitcoin to run their oil tankers through. But we were supposed to have an agreement a week ago. And this whole, you know, I mean, Nick said, you know, we're talking about things you can't believe with Trump. When Trump launched this war, he said, oh, Iran was maybe 2 or 3 weeks away from an attack on Americans, right? Gave this pretext. Didn't seem like, sort of made it up out of whole cloth. How are we supposed to even process all of this, given that we have no idea what's going on because the president isn't reliable?
I mean, he has been threatening to do horrible things about if the Strait of Hormuz isn't open since March 20th. The problem is, when you have a war that started off never being popular, it was never more than 40% of American public opinion was in favor of it, and it's much less now. So that puts, if you have a president who is at all sensitive to American public opinion, and Donald Trump is to some degree sensitive to public opinion and to stock prices. And so that puts kind of a term limit on how much time you can be doing war. There's a lot of people, the John Boltons of the world, who I talked right before the war. You know, one of the fatal flaws of their worldview is that, you know, Bolton has wanted to attack Iran and get rid of the mullahs and get rid of their nuclear program for as long as he's had a mustache. Like, it's just been part of what he does. But what happens is, and at the same time, he'll say that Trump is an incredibly erratic leader who has the memory of a gnat and doesn't have a sense of strategic planning at all, that basically he's incompetent. And also, he's like trying to put John Bolton in jail. Shouldn't those two things kind of like collide in your sort of assessment of the thing? If you want this goal, and your vehicle for that goal is this person who has had a long period of a long history of being sort of hostile towards Iran's expansionism, and which I think is in many parts I agree with him, but it's still Donald Trump that you're doing it with. So what is going to end up happening is that all these people who've been cheering on this intervention because they want to finish the job or do X, Y, and Z are going to throw up their hands and say, well, it's too bad that Donald Trump was so incompetent in doing it. It's going to be the incompetence dodge all over again 20 years after we went through this with Iraq. And we should learn this beforehand. We shouldn't learn it after the fact that, oh, isn't it so weird that our government wasn't good at doing the thing that I've been advocating? Maybe don't advocate for it because the government is a fallen institution.
War is awesome in theory and not in practice, it turns out.
This is also just the consequence, though, of the overpowered executive. Like, yes, everyone did know in advance that this wasn't going to proceed in a orderly and strategic manner. But in the famous words of Donald Rumsfeld, you got to go to war with the army you have. And the army that we have is Donald Trump. And if you're Bolton and you have spent decades gunning for this war, you got to do it under these terms, I think. And yes, you're right that is ultimately a critique of the entire thing. But it like, it's really a critique of investing so much power in a single president and then letting him have at it, which is our only path to do anything at all ever in America right now.
All right. So before we go on this topic, I have a theory I want to run by you guys. I think Republicans need to start thinking about war like tax hikes. Right. They're always like one thing Republicans are super consistent on, even under Donald Trump, where they've been incredibly erratic and given up on many of their first principles. Republicans are against tax hikes. The thing you can count on Republicans to do is be against tax hikes, because tax hikes take money out of people's pockets, right? It's expensive and there's unintended consequences to higher taxes. And they also feel like this is something they can give to voters. Then voters will vote for them knowing that they won't get higher taxes under Republicans. Well, war takes money out of people's pockets, and there's a bunch of economic unintended consequences, and it usually doesn't go so well. It's also like in this case, I think, you know, we've seen this, the Republicans are going after all of this blue state fraud, right? In California, in Minnesota, right? It's a big thing about how blue states, there's a huge amount of welfare fraud in those states, right? Fair enough, that is true. There's also fraud in red states as well, but there is a bunch of fraud in the system. This war constitutes a kind of fraud on the American people because it is sold under false pretenses and it costs them a huge amount of money and also has a whole bunch of economic unintended consequences. Catherine, why can't we get Republicans to just start thinking about war like tax hikes?
I mean, I actually thought you were going to go the other way with this analogy because, in fact, Republicans generally are consistent on war. They are for it. Right. Like they are the party of doing the wars, generally speaking. So with many exceptions. And of course, everyone's doing the wars all the time. Like bipartisanship is bad.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting shift out of, post Reagan or post Clinton, because Bob Dole famously when he was running as Gerald Ford's vice president, talked about how a Ford second term wouldn't get America into all these Democrat wars, by which he meant World War One, World War Two, and Korea and Vietnam. So,
yeah, well, and there is the time honored tradition of running on he kept us out of the war and then getting into a war of whatever stripe you prefer. But I think like if Republicans have to pick one, they're going to pick being pro-war, not being anti-war, sadly. So I love your optimism, Suderman, but I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with you, Catherine, because Peter, I think, Republicans are okay on tax hikes, but they actually, you know, the biggest thing are, you know, they're against them, but they're always in favor of spending hikes, which are implicit tax hikes.
Especially
and
defense.
More to Catherine's point, they believe in American greatness. And the only thing that counts in terms of American greatness is the size of the Pentagon budget and how many, you know, the tonnage of bombs that you drop in any given period of time. So they like it when the American military somehow bombs and invades, maybe occupies, but destroys other parts of the world. That seems to be much more core to their identity than the idea of like, you know what, we're going to deep six that shift from a 36% top marginal rate to 38%.
All right. When we come back, we're going to talk more about national greatness and the problems that it is having globally. Back right after this. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago. It's from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme is Reason and Love. It explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Alexis de Tocqueville. They'll be in small, dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't sit through lectures. They practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students explore Chicago's cultural landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently and speak confidently, to contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week. Scholarships are available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. All right, let's move on to the rest of the world. This weekend, after 16 years in office, Hungary's Viktor Orban was resoundingly defeated in an election. Matt, you've written about Viktor Orban for many years. This is a big loss. What happened? What does it mean?
He got stomped by a former ally who only defected from him a couple of years ago, named Peter Magyar, whose last name is Hungarian. So Peter Hungarian won the Hungarian election. He ran it on an anti-corruption platform because Hungary is the most corrupt country in the EU, which is something that for some reason, all of these American ring kissers and expatriates and people who are in many cases on the payroll of various institutes that are formed by the Hungarian
the
government.
The Danube Institute.
The Danube and the, you know, the Corinthians, whatever the hell, continuum. All these prog rock sounding places.
Institute, yeah.
They don't care. And it's I have an actual hostility towards American apologists for Viktor Orban, because in 16 years is a long time to come up with a track record. I recommend anyone who's interested in the subject to please do read Johan Norberg's great piece for Cato Institute at the end of March, where he detailed in very exhaustive detail all of the ways that Hungary, on every single international measuring stick by every single organization of every single ideological stripe, has been decelerating, degrading faster than just about any other country. It's the only country in the European Union rated as partly free as opposed to free. It is more corrupt than Romania, which is wow. You know, longer teeth than Dracula kind of thing. Like, what are you talking about? Every single press freedom, rule of law, all of this, and then also economic deliverance on all of that. There, when I lived there and moved there in 1995, it was at the front of the line, basically the post-communist economies. People sort of looked at that as the role model for privatization and all these kind of things. It is now almost as far back as Romania, which was absolutely destroyed as a country compared to Hungary in the 1980s because of Nicolae Ceausescu. So what are the results? Our American apologist friends don't care about any of this. They just like that he's tough on immigration, that he has the right enemies. He's up against Globo Homo. I wish that was a made up term, but it's not. He hates Brussels and the European Union. And so therefore he's fine. And he's pro-family, at least in rhetoric, and calling himself pro-Western civilization and in Christianity, even though his people are becoming less Christian by the minute. So all of that came back to haunt him, and an anti-corruption coalition of just like anyone but Orban won resoundingly. And I think that's great news for Hungarians. It's good news for America, too. We shouldn't be meddling into an election to the extent that we did. Had J.D. Vance there 5 days before an election warning about foreign interference in the election and just disgracing himself. I think the sooner that American conservatives get out of Hungarian style nationalism, the better. And in the meantime, any of those people who've been engaged in that apologia should not be anywhere near political power in this country, because they're telling on themselves about what they want for us, which is crap.
This is a big win for Globo Homo.
Yeah,
what I heard.
But what's it going to do to Paprika?
Paprika is enduring. You cannot keep Paprika down ever.
That is correct.
Key ingredient in many great barbecue rubs. There's a whole bunch of stuff going here, right? There's the sort of social conservative angle here, right? Like, that's what the Globo Homo stuff is about. Like, that's a huge part of why American apologists for Orban said he was great, was they liked that he said the right things in terms of social conservative ideas about, you know, family growth, about pornography, about that sort of thing. But it seems to me, Nick, like, he lost because he was a nationalist and a populist, and the whole, like, the core idea of nationalism and populism is we're going to deliver for our people. And his economy sucked. It tanked, right? He just, like, there was no growth, and you can't sell a shitty economy to people under the banner of nationalism and populism.
Yeah, one hopes that, you know, eventually the economic reality of things impinges on whatever narrative you want to put out there. And, you know, the fact is, if you become more protectionist, if you become more autarkist, you know, trying to do everything yourself and to block interactions with other countries, particularly ones that you neighbor, in favor of like currying alliances with countries like Russia, you know, that great respecter of national boundaries and of modernity and of, you know, and of anything decent, It's going to come up and it's going to kneecap you. And it's good to see that. The other thing that is fascinating about this is Orban was a master of social media. There's a great book whose author I'm forgetting called Charisma that came out last year that talked about how different leaders use social media in particular to kind of connect with audiences. And Orban's profile within Hungary was very different than he often was when he appeared on the national stage. But he appeared as, you know, one of the people that he was with, the regular people who had been left behind, the forgotten men and women of Hungary, so to speak. So it's really genuinely fascinating that ultimately you can, you know, you can project an image for as long as you want. But in the end, what matters to most people over time is, you know, is basic economic reality and the ability to get on with your life in the way that you want to. And he didn't deliver, so he's gone.
I also think the scenes of election day were very, very striking. There's this kind of moment where, like, Orban concedes pretty early because it's like just looking very bad for him. And you can kind of see, like, in the footage, in the coverage, everyone is in shock. Like, it's not just how quickly the election returns came back. I think Orban was such a huge and sort of felt permanent part of what was happening in Hungary by this time. I mean, you know, 12 years is a long time. And I know there were fears about, you know, would he honor election results, that kind of thing, just like there are here in some quarters. And I think I kind of had this moment of like, oh, actually, you can do an election. And then, you know, he's not gone forever. And his speech, his outgoing speech, he did kind of say, like, you haven't seen the last of me, Batman or whatever. Sorry, I got my superheroes wrong. But
I'll be back.
But
that's the governor of California.
The fact that things can turn on an election in a meaningful way, and that Magyar came in and said, you know, we're going to try and normalize relations with the EU and just like get shit back to normal, was very heartening. I thought the shock was a great part of it. Like the bad times can be over.
Well, that was partly because it's a huge blowout, which is very unlikely, for example, in the United States. The way our elections work now is, you know, a 5 to 7 point spread in a presidential election would be gigantic, right? A 3 point win is a very solid big win. And this was much bigger than that.
I mean, I'm old enough to remember when Donald Trump unexpectedly beat Hillary Clinton and we all went, wait, what? And there was a moment of shock. And then we moved on to this like new political situation that had just been created. So.
Matt, what do you think about J.D. Vance's role in all this? You mentioned it just a little bit, but he's sort of the front person for a lot of the Trump administration's global ambassadoring right now. He was in Islamabad negotiating the deal that didn't go through with Iran. He went and met the previous pope, not the one that the Trump administration is currently beefing with, right, last year. And he also went, as you said, to campaign for Viktor Orban.
Yeah, 5 days before the election. It shows maybe that J.D. Vance doesn't have that much pack to his punch. Wasn't a very effective campaign message.
Well, he did kill the Pope, though.
That is true.
We can't prove that. That's an allegation.
I think that his performance was shameful. He was praising Viktor Orban for creating energy independence, which doesn't make any sense at all. They are incredibly dependent on Russia. That's how they just negotiated good deals with Russia on their oil by being literally, in Viktor Orban's word, I will be a mouse to your lion, Mr. Putin, in taped recordings that got leaked before the election. Crazy, crazy scenes. And so to praise them, he even made some comment of like, oh, you know, the EU bureaucrats, they're always talking about corruption, but they never talk about their own corruption. It's like, my dude. Hungary's economy and governance has been ranked now as corrupt as basically China and Cuba. It is famously, infamously corrupt. This has been documented so many times over the last 16 years, and you're going to hand wave over here. And meanwhile, the other thing that he used to hand wave when he was at the Munich Security Conference last year was like, oh, Russia doesn't, you know, you guys are all excited about Russia interfering in election, and you're just getting mad over a couple of hundred thousand, like, or even a couple of thousand, you know, ad spend on Facebook, you know, get over it. Okay, so he's minimizing Russia's very real ability and chicanery in Romania elections, among others. And then during his trip in Budapest, he accused Brussels of engaging in the worst election interference he has ever read about. That's quite the allegation. So that's one reason why I was really worried that this was going to be close enough for Orban to challenge it in a Trump style fashion, because then what would J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio, who also went and did his campaign visit, and Donald Trump do? And thankfully, we don't have to think about that counterfactual at all, because Orban got trounced. I hope that maybe some of the, I know they won't, but I hope that some of the American nationalists who decided they really liked international nationalism start to grapple with the fact that there's a fundamental incoherence in that term, and note that a lot of the nationalist parties that the Trump administration is, a poor, according to its own national security strategy, they're going to try to support through means who knows. Those parties have been turning against Trump for nationalist reasons, because he does stuff like threatens to invade Greenland, and they think that's bad. There's an incoherence in nationalist internationalism, and this election demonstrated that.
Matt, just real quick, since you made the comparison of Orban's corruption to other countries, how does it compare to the United States? And I'm actually asking this sort of seriously, because you've written and given a great presentation about the specifics of Trump's corruption, how it compares, for example, to Biden's corruption. How do you think about the two? How do you think about the Orban-Trump connection here? And it just, I mean, Trump is more corrupt, is one of the things that you have convinced me of, than most U.S. presidents. Why do the populists, the nationalists, always end up being so corrupt?
Well, because what are you aiming to do? What have some of the sort of theoreticians behind modern kind of Trumpian conservatism, what do they want? They want to use government to punish their enemies and reward their friends. What does that look like in practice? It looks like corruption. It looks like saying, I'm going to preemptively pardon anyone who's served in my administration. That's corrupt. Biden did that, too, on his way out the door with the members of his own family. Like, they might get, charged someday. So let's preemptively pardon them. And Trump's been threatening that, too. But also the rewarding. I'm going to get my people in charge of media companies. I'm going to expropriate, like force out a bunch of banks, and then get my politically connected guys to buy those shares from those banks. That's just applied nationalism becomes corruption. It's almost inevitable, I think.
All right, let's switch topics a little bit here. I want to talk about California. Eric Swalwell, Catherine, Democratic congressman who is running for governor of California. He's out of the race.
Yep.
What happened there?
Something bad. I have not been following this closely because I had hoped that I wouldn't have to know any more facts about Eric Swalwell ever. But I have brushed up this morning, and the tidbit that I think is getting undercovered in this story is he is also under investigation by DHS for hiring a Brazilian nanny who overstayed her visa. And to me, that is somehow the icing on the cake. It's like
the icing
on the cake. And, I obviously don't ever think we should have Nannygate. Everyone should hire whoever they want to be the nanny for their children. Visas be damned. But the kind of the late breaking pile on, including DHS just waking up the next day and saying like, we heard you have this illegal nanny. Bonkers stuff. So he's out. Under a variety of allegations about sexual misbehavior, to say the least. And unfortunately, all of our other choices are still terrible.
Yeah. Speaking of other terrible choices, Kamala Harris. Nick, she says she's thinking about running again. Do you think she has
any
chance? Sure, right. She has nothing else to do.
Partly free country.
She cannot conceive of, she has nothing she wants to do as president. She just wants to be president. She cannot conceive of herself.
She's got
in
like
any
3 years. She's got like 3 years to think about it this time instead of 3 weeks. So she'll come up with something.
Do you think she has a chance to win even a single state primary?
No, I don't think so. I'm hoping that the 2028 presidential season, it will be filled with people that we're not even talking about now, because it seems to me that the detritus of the I don't know what we want to call the last 10 years, because it, you know, it sits astride two decades, but it's just been terrible. I mean, and, you know, I just don't see anybody who is really in the public arena right now doing that well. I mean, I hope that somebody like Rand Paul generates more heat and interest as he moves closer and closer to announcing a presidential run. I don't think that's going to happen. But on the Democratic side, the thing that is amazing is, you know, there does not seem to be any interest in revisiting what went wrong, what led them to losing in 2024. Kamala Harris is a big part of that. Joe Biden is a big part of that. The policies that the Democrats, you know, enacted between 2020, winning in 2020 and losing in 2024, big part of that. And the fact that we're even talking about Harris now is, you know, is just more of that conversation.
It's a messaging problem. It's always a messaging problem, right? You never need to change your policies.
Well, in the sense that, to give the Democrats some credence on that, it is, they're going to win at least the House in the midterms, almost certainly, possibly the Senate. And it's not because they're putting forward a bold new vision of what it means to be American and how to make America great ever. I mean, it's basically all they have to do is not have an R after their name. And that's the, you know, that's what politics have been for almost all of the 21st century.
Yeah, it's a real problem right now. Both parties are just hoping that the other party is even less well-liked than they are, right? So Democrats think we don't need to change because Republicans are screwing it up. Nobody likes, you know, the high prices, the tariffs, the war in Iran. Everybody is increasingly thinks that Donald Trump is kind of crazy. Even the kind of, you know, Joe Rogan types are turning on him because of the workplace immigration raids. And so they think we don't need to change because people are just going to hate Republicans and under Trump so much that they'll vote for us. But if you look at the polls are really kind of interesting on this. People hate Democrats even more. The Democratic brand, the Democratic Party brand is absolutely just in the bottom of the trash can that is on fire. And it's because of progressives, progressive policies on social issues, but also on economic issues. People just don't like it. Democrats are going to have to change. They need to learn that. And the fact that Kamala Harris is even considering a run shows that they aren't. All right.
I'm not a Democrat, but I feel like I, too, am at the bottom of the trash can that's on fire.
Oh, Catherine, we're gonna try and lift you up when we come back here with a question that you're going to love about Bruce Springsteen. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Do you know a student looking for a serious intellectual experience that strengthens the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students ages 16 to 24 to the 2026 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 25th to August 1st. This year's theme is Reason and Love. It explores the ideas that shape character, choice, and human flourishing. Students engage directly with thinkers like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, Alexis de Tocqueville. They'll be in small, dynamic discussion groups where every claim requires evidence and reasoning. They don't just sit through lectures. They're going to practice thinking for themselves. Outside the seminar room, students will have other activities. They can explore Chicago's landmarks, analyze art firsthand, experience live improv comedy, and build friendships rooted in shared intellectual ambition. Parents, if you want your student equipped to reason independently, speak confidently, and contribute meaningfully to a free society, this program was built for them. Registration is just $900, and that includes room for the full week. Scholarships are also available. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason. All right. As always, a reminder, we do love to answer your questions. You should send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That is podcasts@reason.com. Please put the words listener question in your subject line so that I know that it's a listener question. This week's listener question comes from Ben. It is, as promised, about Bruce Springsteen. He writes, "Hello, Cavaliers." Not a basketball team. Is it all right for an American?
It's the wrong side in the English Civil War. We are roundheads.
That's right. Thank you, History Dad. Is it all right for an American, especially a libertarian, to love Born in the USA by Bruce Springsteen? On the one hand, it's a strong, cynical critique of how Vietnam vets were treated, but it also feels upbeat and patriotic. almost like the song is saying, America can do so much better. Nick, Matt, do you guys want to like do a coin toss or a fight or something? Who gets to answer this
Nick's
one first?
Nick's got to start.
Matt can do this.
All right. So the I'll start by saying that 5 days ago, this came up in my life because I was driving with my 11-year-old daughter and we were listening to a station that was playing a lot of 80s songs. And I was like talking about this. So Footloose comes out. I'm like, well, as a matter of fact, this was the theme song of a weird movie in which the bad preacher was telling the kids they couldn't dance. And she thought that was interesting. Everybody Wants the Rule to Rule the World comes on. I'm like, yeah, this song's pretty great. She liked that too. Born in the USA comes on. And we listen for about 15 seconds. She says, Dad, can we change the station? This song is boring. She's right. She's right. Song was boring in 1984 or five, whenever it came out. that snare sound, terrible. Yeah. To answer your question, literally, yes, it's okay to love the song because everyone should love whatever they want musically. And the song does strike some of those notes. I'm more interested in its place. There is this sort of like heartland rock thing that happened in the early 80s, Johnny Cougar, Mellencamp's Scarecrow, Billy Joel's Nylon Curtain, and of course Styx's Paradise Theater, that we're all like, yeah, we're down, but we're not out, man.
We're just running against the wind, Matt.
We're running against the wind.
Bob Seger, if you're talking about heartland rock.
And I love all of those precisely for some of the reasons that you mentioned here, which is that like, even though they're kind of critiques of Reagan's America, they're also like kind of upbeat and patriotic and, you know, always lead with patriotism as you're critiquing America, in my view.
My college roommate would have agreed with your daughter. When I was in college, it was around when The Rising came out. Oh, yeah. And occasionally he would just go into like long rants about Bruce Springsteen that would end with him doing a Springsteen impression that was, he just says The Rising. Like every 15 seconds for about 10 minutes, just because The Rising. And he waits for you to talk. The Rising, right? And it's just.
So that's where you learned
it? The best thing to know about The Rising is that all those songs were written before 9/11.
Yeah. No, they
And then he it. Just, he's like, okay, now I got a good hook to release the album.
That's a good hook for you to answer the question, Nick.
Yeah, I of course you can love this song, as did Ronald Reagan, who used it against the boss's wishes, because it connected with audiences in different ways depending on who the audience was and whether or not they cared about the lyrics. The great thing about rock music, and I don't know, I know Matt is solidly in the rock era like I am, but like the greatest thing about rock and roll, besides everything. And besides, it is the thing that set us free. When you hear all the early 70s songs just about how, like, before rock, there was nothing. And now we are free and we can, you know, little Jenny in Lou Reed's Rock and Roll, like, is finally, nothing was going on. Now everything is possible. But the greatest thing about rock music is that nobody knows the lyrics to their favorite songs, especially back then, because there was no place to find the lyrics. They were never written down anywhere. So it's like, fuck you. You can listen to any song you want and appropriate to whatever need you need in the moment. Rock and roll is always just what you needed.
Catherine, you have a lot of thoughts on Bruce Springsteen, or do you just want to go to talking about the robots?
I don't have one single thought about Bruce Springsteen, but I will defend Ben's choice of referring to us as Cavaliers. I think he meant it in the sense of a gallant gentleman or perhaps some kind of a mounted soldier, which we are the Knights of the Round Table, and therefore...
Those aren't Cavaliers.
Also,
the Cavaliers specifically were the horsemen for the crown, for Charles the First. Fuck
that's
that.
That's true.
And fuck the University of Virginia, too, which is, you know, is a, you know, it's a Southern apologist university. We don't need that. We're always on the side of the roundheads of the lumpen people and the people moving into cities. That the
There's a broader meaning, which I'm using, and we are sometimes a bit cavalier.
That's true.
That's true.
I think we should talk about the robots now. Okay?
Okay.
AI, Claude Mythos Preview. That's the name of the new AI model from Anthropic, which is one of the two big leading frontier labs, right? So it was released last week, and Anthropic claims it represents, their words were, a step change in AI capability, especially where coding and security research are concerned. They say it's found thousands of exploits in widely used software programs, including every major operating system and browser. And they also say the model is too powerful to release to the public. So they're only releasing it to 40 trusted companies, basically, so that they can sort of figure out what this thing can do and how it can break into all of the systems. I'm interested in the way that this repositions big tech companies vis-a-vis the government, Catherine. And so there's a bunch of kind of interesting just like, you know, computer security stuff here. But there are people who are saying that this flips the balance of power between corporations and governments, because now there's a private corporation that holds a tool that could conceivably hack into maybe every single government system in the world.
Yeah, I'm in favor of things that disempower governments. And I get why people are nervous about this, and it's reasonable enough to be like, okay, well, I guess like there's five guys who hold the entire world's fate in their hands, first of all.
And make you delicious hamburgers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they sure do. First of all, I suspect that some of this is hype and PR, and it may be in some cases unselfconscious, or you know, maybe unself-aware that these guys are very, very excited about the thing that they built and how powerful it is. And naturally, they're going to hype it up. You see this over and over in the earlier stages of AI, where there would always be one guy inside of each company that was like, it's alive. And, you know, it's like it wasn't alive yet, at least.
Well, and in fact, when the head of Anthropic was at ChatGPT, the ChatGPT actually delayed the release of a very early model for kind of similar reasons.
Yeah. And I think in general, I am in favor of self-policing. Right. So, yes, you know, you saw this to some extent with Anthropic's fight with the Pentagon, where they said, we're not going to make a contract with you where our products are used to do things that we think are morally wrong and that we had previously established as something that we're not going to do in our charter, in our rules. Similarly, I think it is totally legitimate for a company to build a product and then say, whoa, this isn't ready for wide release and we're going to do something different with it. It is a cartel for sure. And it is all the problems of a cartel are attendant on it. And I would still rather have these idiots do this instead of like the FTC and Congress and the Commerce Department and the European Union and like 17 blue state attorneys general, like gradually getting around to making an incredibly dumb rule that doesn't directly address the concerns, which I think is our other option. So I kind of dig it.
I don't think that the choice is that stark. And I can only read this as complete hype bullshit from Anthropic. It's brilliant. It's a brilliant PR strategy. And they're taking a page from ChatGPT that did this something similar in 2019. Because if they had actually discovered, oh my God, our program is going to allow us to run the world, they wouldn't be like, and so we're going to not release it and we're just going to work with a couple of our allies. Like, sorry, this is, you know, the tech industry has a proven track record of overhyping virtually everything. And then when stuff lands and hits and gets worked through, it can be transformative, but rarely in the way that people say on the time schedule they say. So props to Anthropic, because they should be smacking the government as hard as possible and like, and kind of saying like, you know what, we have power too. Because the way that Pete Hegseth in particular, but the Trump administration more broadly threatened them with essentially like extermination because of a contractual disagreement, you know, more power to them. But like, I'm not worried about, you know, that if, my God, if this escapes Anthropic's control, it's going to be all over. And every operating system, you know, going back to the abacus, will be retroactively disabled. Like, I think it's hype.
I do also think, you know, the fact that they are sharing it with this limited group is the strongest piece of evidence that it is not a world killer, right? Like, if in fact you held in your hands a thing that was potentially catastrophic, you wouldn't share it with 40 of your closest friends and also, by the way, direct rivals. Like, but I still think like you have to give credit to the fact that each new iteration of these tools has been astonishingly more powerful. That the shape of the curve is very much an exponential curve. And so, I'm inclined to believe them when they say this is a big deal. You know, how big a deal? TBD.
I mean, there are some funny stories hidden in some of like the footnotes of the releases on this and kind of funny, but also a little bit terrifying, where this thing was like given a task and was not connected to the internet not allowed to be connected to the internet, and figured out how to connect itself to the internet so that it could email one of the researchers who got an email from Claude Mythos Preview while like eating a tuna sandwich in the park, right? So there's stories like that. But then the other thing in terms of the maybe it's not hype. Look, I agree, it's hard to know. It's really hard to know exactly how powerful this is. Even if you could use it yourself, it's like, it's very difficult to kind of judge these things. But in the weeks before this came out, you saw some of the benchmarks leak that's not been disputed. It seems like it's just much more powerful on the kind of traditional benchmarks. And the other thing that's been happening that people haven't taken as much notice of is that there are all of these open source sort of repositories for bugs and software. And there's been a lot of kind of mysterious uploads of like, hey, there's a bug here. Hey, there's a bug here in all these this open source software. And it's pretty clear that that's coming from the Claude Mythos team, even if they are not necessarily directly admitting it. So they are finding bugs and alerting people where they can and where they think that it makes sense without taking credit for it is, I think, what is happening. Again, this is that's a little bit speculative, but it does seem to be what is happening here. Matt, I want to ask you about the backlash, the political backlash. As our technology correspondent, we've got the Bernie Sanders and Josh Hawley both sponsoring anti-data center bills. Maine became the first state to ban data centers through the end of 2027. What do you think about that sort of political backlash here where people are worried about, oh, they're going to build data centers, they're going to take all of our jobs. We've got to find some way to regulate this technology before it becomes even more useful.
I knew that Bernie was up to something bad or was going to be up to something bad soon when my 17-year-old came home about 8-9 days ago and said, Dad, the data centers are taking all the water.
Just
we're running out of water. I'm like, yeah. I am to AI what Catherine is to Bruce Springsteen, sure, but I don't think that's true. My 17-year-old taught her, and she tried to say, well, you know, they taught me this at school. The teacher knows about the environment, and this is really bad. I'm like, I bet that if you study this a little bit, you'll find that AI is not taking all the water just yet. And then in classic 17-year-old fashion, in about 2 minutes, she's like, yeah, probably they're probably just lying to me. I don't know. And stopped caring about it altogether. But that's like, okay, then we're going to see some really stupid legislation from Bernie Sanders in 10 seconds. It seems to me like super obvious that people are trying to locate their perhaps very understandable anxiety about what AI is going to do with us onto a thing, onto an edifice. There's a center over there, which is why the Joanna Andreessen's cover for a reason was phenomenal about the data centers. They're all beautiful dolphins somehow. It's a thing to like point at and say that's a bad thing. And so it's like a purely symbolic kind of opposition. So I kind of love it just for art's sake. There's going to be a political backlash to all new tech right now. We're in a tech grump political era, even as, on an individual level, all of us are embracing tech, whether we want to or not. And some of us really don't want to. It's going to be a lot of stupid policies like Catherine was alluding to.
Yeah, there's been so much cope when it comes to AI. First, people are like, this is fake. It's not very useful. Right. Last year, we were in a bubble. This thing was just the technology was petering out. It was never going to be very functional. That was the line. Well, now it looks like maybe it can hack into just about anything. So people are like, well, the water usage for the largest data centers is equivalent to about 2 burger joints. To about 2 McDonald's, right? Like, so unless you are out there protesting every single installation of a Shake Shack, a McDonald's, or a Wendy's, because each 2 of them is going to use so much water that it's going to starve America, then like, stop protesting, stop being mad about AI's water use, because that's not the problem. Now people are like, well, you know what? We're just going to have to talk about the jobs and slop, right? Like this is, and it's just at every point they come up with a new reason, a new excuse. It's all cope. AI is going to change the world. It's also going to be super hyped. There's going to be people who are overstating its capabilities, but AI is going to change the world. It's going to make it a better place. There are risks here. We got to look out for them, but like this is a good thing, and you should like it's going to come for you whether or not you want it to.
And it'll come to Maine last because Maine is a poor state because it's run by idiots. It's a shame. Maine could use something like this. It is the Mississippi of the North, But Mississippi of the South is doing extremely well in education and in locating and siting data centers. They've gotten the message. It's a shame that Maine is not.
Well, one reason why Maine was able to ban data centers until the end of 2027 is because they probably weren't going to have any data centers built anyway, because electricity is already so expensive. It's like European levels of expensive, maybe not literally exactly, but close, especially relative to all of the lower tax red states. Republicans, you're pretty good on taxes, pretty good on energy. You got to get on board with being pretty good on not going to war, too, because it's the same thing, guys. Telling you, it's the same thing. All right, let's move on to our cultural recommendations. We're going to start with Catherine, who is going to give us an update on the Artemis moon mission. Pretty cool photos. They got back safely.
It worked out. They splashed down. It was successful. The many highlights, to be honest, the photography to me is the best part. And I'm generally not a, ooh, look what the telescope saw space girly. I'm a look at the rocket go boom space girly. There's an important distinction there. But the photos of like Earthrise and the kind of various impossible to see from Earth quasi eclipses were really very neat. And as you know, the one place where I am really a sucker for human interest stories is space stuff. So the naming of the crater for one of the astronauts' late wife who died of cancer. Just good stuff. Just the bros in space. Like, men will literally go to the dark side of the moon instead of going to therapy. But in this case, I can only assume my guy astronaut did both. You know, it's nice that it worked out. I think people tend to extrapolate from NASA successfully did a thing to, first of all, America is great. And second, space should be done by the government. I don't necessarily think that the success of this mission was a referendum on the other two, but I am happy that Artemis II and its crew are back, intact, successful.
Catherine, I think you once told me that you don't really feel awe. That like this is like you don't get the little tinglies in your back when something awesome happens, when you see like a good movie or a play, right? You don't get the little tear when you're of joyful off like happiness at like that was a thing that happened that was so wonderful. But it sounds like you're getting a little bit of awe from the rockets.
It's the drugs.
I get awe from the rockets. I have taken some personality tests in my day that find that I have low awe scores, but I think they probably changed somewhat in my old age. So I'll go back and take another one and report back.
I'll always consider you to be awesome.
Aw,
that's right. Matt Welch, what do you have for us?
So I've watched about half of the three-part miniseries, executive produced by Ken Burns, shockingly, on Henry David Thoreau. And I pronounce it intentionally because they don't. They pronounce it unintentionally or intentionally in the different way of Henry David Thoreau.
Thoreau.
Okay. Thoreau.
Like the comic book character Thor with an O?
Oh, a bit. And it's a bit distracting. I'm not going to lie about that. The two parts of the documentary, which is just kind of classic Ken Burns executive produced fare about a very interesting and formative American writer and thinker who I've always had an inexplicable chip on my shoulder against. I think it's a foundational LA versus Boston kind of thing or something. Maybe it has to do with the fact that the only paper I wrote in all of high school that I didn't get an A on was an open letter to Henry David Thoreau calling him like a bullshit artist. So maybe that has something to do with it too, but it has awakened many of those feelings. But the other tough thing to digest besides the Thoreau is that at the top, it's like executive produced Ken Burns and Don Henley. Like it's really hard.
Yeah. Because of the Walden Woods, right?
Because of Walden Woods. It's hard, man. To get over that. My defense of sticking to Henry David Thoreau, besides the fact that we're not going to start calling him Steven Seagal now, mm-hmm. suddenly, it's Steven Seagal. That's how the language works.
What about Tony Dorsett?
I was a Dorsett. I was like, that's okay. The way that American language wants it to go. Is that Thoreau, one of the greatest things about him is that he was like a classic tale or exemplar of American self-reinvention. And, you know, he like literally kind of created the model. I'm just going to go to the woods, man, and hunker down and describe what I see and therefore discover more about my life, myself, nature, fundamental human reality, and all this kind of stuff. You know, every band that goes in woodsheds for a year is kind of doing Thoreau in the woods. And so as part of that,
it's like eat, pray, love for dudes.
A bit. And for like dudes in their 20s specifically, it's like Steppenwolf shit. Part of that is like the idea is that it's always self-reinvention. Like we should repurpose Thoreau for our own uses. Martin Luther King repurposed Thoreau for his own use spectacularly. It's wonderful. Václav Havel, who's on the poster overlooking my shoulder as we speak, repurposed Thoreau for his own uses. So that repurposing should also include we're going to pronounce his name as it should be, which isn't Thoreau. It's Henry David Thoreau.
May I weigh in on this important matter?
Yes.
As someone whose name is very frequently mispronounced and is also a weird Americanized bastardization of whatever its Romanian origins once were, I really resonate with this quote from our main man, Henry David Thoreau, who says, "A name pronounced is the recognition of the individual to whom it belongs. He who can pronounce my name aright is entitled to my love and service."
That sounds made up. Have you checked that? Or yeah.
It was in the New Yorker. I feel that, like that's pretty legit.
Oh, yeah. I want to point out that Thoreau, I have totally lost the ability to remember how I am supposed to pronounce it already. But he had a bunch of Irish men, take down a cab and move it to Walden Woods. And then he walked back into town almost every night to have dinner cooked for him. And laundry done for him by Ralph Waldo Emerson's mother and his aunt who bailed him out of jail. He is a fascinating character who is one of the great individualist heroes of America and also one of the most annoying people who ever existed on the page.
Absolutely true.
I wrote a paper about him in middle school about how he was a fake individualist because of all that stuff.
Yeah.
Wow. The Suderman Welsh school paper convergence is not something I had on my bingo card today.
I got to nail that paper.
But it's also civil disobedience is one of the great libertarian documents in human history. And I was talking with Matt's co-host on the fifth column, Camille Foster, about Thoreau a while ago. And I think it's a real loss to the culture that Thoreau, and maybe this documentary series will help restart interest in him, but like even through some point in the 70s, Thoreau was much more of a kind of culture hero. And I think he's a good referent in terms of, you know, it's not his quote, but marching to the beat of his drum or to be an individualist rather than to go with the crowd for sure.
So speaking of things that end in O and maybe don't are hard to pronounce, I saw live the band that may be able to claim to be the heaviest heavy metal band ever. And this is a band that is named after an old speaker manufacturer that was beloved by The Who, Jimi Hendrix. They were sort of didn't exist for a while and now come back. And the band and the speakers are called Sun with two N's, S-U-N-N. And then there is an O with three parentheses after it. So it looks like it's Sun O, except you just pronounce it Sun with no O at all. Mm-hmm. So I saw Sun. This is a band that I first encountered about 20 years ago in the New York Times Magazine, of all places, a piece titled Heady Metal, about this sort of then up and coming kind of obscure band that was again the heaviest band ever, and not in the way that like you normally think about sort of screaming, thrashing, or a big. No, it's just two guys with guitars. Just two guys with guitars. They don't sing at all. There's no drums. There's no bass. There's no melody. There's no lyrics. All they are trying to do is make the guitars as low and as loud as possible. And so they are famed for their absolutely intense, like literally body cavity shaking shows, where the point is not to hear music be played in some sort of like, oh, there's a song here that you can make out. It's just drone metal. And it just drones and drones and drones. You have to wear earplugs. This is the only time I've ever worn earplugs to a concert. Mm. It was recommended to me by Freddie DeBoer, of all people, who has seen this band play a dozen times.
Is this made in a laboratory to make me hate it?
And it's just, it's an incredible sonic embodiment experience, right? Where what you are doing is, you know, like there are people who will like go, like put their hands in the air because you can feel the sound waves coming off of the stage. You can touch the chair in front of you and just feel the drone of it. It's in some ways, it's like being on an airplane. You can feel it in your chest, in your kneecaps, in your head, right? Even with like, I literally got these earplugs were rated for pilots, right? Or were supposed to be, right? Like you got to protect your ears there. And it's like, no, like you just feel it in all through your chest. It goes for an hour and a half. You can't tell when one song stops, starts, begins, right? They have albums. If anybody ever wants to listen to an album, I recommend Life Metal, which was recorded by Steve Albini, who we've talked about on this podcast, but absolutely phenomenal, just experience of like what sound can do to your body. And like you get this sense that maybe if it were just a little bit louder, they could liquefy the entire crowd. And that's, it's so beautiful and cathartic and kind of weirdly relaxing. Nick, what do you have for us? Nick Gillespie.
My name is mispronounced all the time, which I find kind of strange because it seems kind of obvious. But I read in anticipation of interviewing the authors, a book called The Future of Free Speech, Reversing the Global Decline of Democracy's Most Essential Freedom. It's by Jacob Mishingama and Jeff Kossoff, who are two incredible scholars of free speech. Jacob Mishingama wrote a book, a history of free speech from Socrates to social media a couple years ago, which is phenomenal and encyclopedic. Jeff Kossoff has done at least three books, one defending Section 230, one defending anonymous speech, one defending false speech, like creating legal protections for false speech. Between them, they are like, you know, they're the glimmer twins of free expression. And this book is, you know, predicated upon the idea, they point out that for the 14th year in a row, Freedom House has noted or has documented a decline in internet freedom and free expression globally. So it is, why is that happening and how to reverse it? And it is just, it's a phenomenal book that is so important because they go into government attempts to censor speech, corporate attempts to censor speech, cultural attempts to censor speech. And, you know, so they are very plugged into every possible argument where people are standing astride, you know, expression and saying, no, we should have less of this or it should be regulated more. And one of the things, you know, that they keep coming back to because they, you know, they point out again and again that the second half of the 20th century was a golden age for the expansion of free speech globally and especially in America. But they come back to the George Orwell quote, which goes, if large numbers of people are interested in freedom of speech, there will be freedom of speech, even if the law forbids it. If public opinion is sluggish, inconvenient minorities will be persecuted, even if laws exist to protect them. So the book is a kind of performative, attempt to really shift the way that we think about free speech. Because in the end, technology enables free speech. It also enables the suppression of speech. Governments both ways, culture both ways. Like we need to be, you know, cognizant of the fact that we are in a free speech moment, a moment where free speech is incredibly imperiled across every possible perspective and part of our lives. And this is the antidote. This gives you the arguments for why free speech is good, why it expanded, who benefited from that, and why we should get back to that program rather than the one we're on.
Okay, we are going to end this moment of free speech, but we'll be back next week. If you like what we do here, you can give us money at reason.com/donate. If you like the Reason Roundtable, if you like what the Reason Foundation does, that's reason.com/donate. Thank you all so much for listening, for tuning in. The Reason Roundtable will return.